Kansas is full of good men. I want to be a great one.
I'm Bob Smithhauser, and you're listening to the official Plugged In podcast. We've got a couple of great men with us today. First, Adam Holtz is here to chop through the morals, messages, and magic in the PG Yellow Brick Road prequel, Oz the Great and Powerful. Adam, you in there? What's that? Oil can? Oh.
Thanks. That's much better. It's good to be back. Can you believe the last time I was on the podcast was in early January?
Really? Wow, no wonder you're a little rusty. But you picked a good week to be here. Did you know a Disney princess is having a birthday?
Yeah, which one?
Mulan turns 15 this year and just arrived on Blu-ray Tuesday. We're going to share a conversation with the film's director, Tony Bancroft. He's a Christian with quite a history at the studio. You'll hear Tony explain how his own faith impacted the portrayal of Eastern religion in Mulan. He also tells us about the bittersweet moment he learned that the world of animation would never be the same. Then we'll answer listener mail and tell you how our world is changing right here at Plugged In. Our sponsor this week is the American Bible Challenge. The game show of biblical proportions is back for a second season, premiering March 21st on GSN. Gather the family together with host Jeff Foxworthy and test your Bible knowledge. That's the American Bible Challenge, only on GSN.
Have you finally joined her side, sister? I simply want peace. It's all I ever wanted, and the wizard can do that. He's a good man.
Oh, what do you know about goodness? Deep down, you are wicked.
You're not wicked!
Well, wicked or not, a little anger management might be a good idea. Nearly 75 years after the release of The Wizard of Oz, we get a new film providing backstory for some of L. Frank Baum's classic characters. It tore up the box office like a Kansas tornado last weekend. $150 million worldwide. So, Adam, how'd you like Oz the Great and Powerful?
Well, you know, my wife and I saw it on IMAX in 3D, and I have to say, we really enjoyed it, Bob. I found it a very immersive, popcorn-munching kind of flick that's full of adventure and special effects and some interesting characters, as we're going to talk about. And I think it was a movie that, you know, didn't disappoint me, and it didn't, you know, probably blow my socks off completely, but I really enjoyed it on the whole.
Well, our listeners may recall that at the end of The Wizard of Oz, the wizard tells Dorothy that he flew in from Kansas too, and that's where this story really takes off, isn't it?
That's right. Oz the Great and Powerful tells the story of how the Wizard of Oz got to Oz in the first place. That sounds like a lot of Oz, doesn't it? Oscar Diggs is a small-time magician with aspirations towards greatness. But kind of undermining his greatness is the fact that, well, he's really just a small-time con man who works in a traveling circus early in the century. And he's in Kansas when, surprise, surprise, he ends up in a hot air balloon that gets sucked into a tornado. And when he comes to, he's not in Kansas anymore. He's in the land of Oz, this magical, colorful realm. And he's not there very long before he meets a beautiful witch named Theodora. And Theodora lets him know that there's been a prophecy that a man named Oz would be coming to set the realm free from the clutches of the wicked witch. And you know, he knows that he doesn't have any special powers, but he kind of plays along, and it's not long before, you know, she's really falling in love with him and projecting herself into the role of Queen of Oz and you know, sort of delusions of grandeur while, you know, he's sort of in trouble. And, you know, the reason he's playing along is he's in love with the idea of being the heir to Oz's, you know, immense treasure. So it's everything he ever wanted. It's greatness, it's money, it's women. And all of a sudden he sees a real opportunity here. And, you know, they haven't been traveling long when they run into a talking flying monkey named Finley.
Yeah, and he's a bit concerned with Oz's ethical sleight of hand.
Oh, every lie you tell gets us one step closer to the Emerald City dungeon.
And don't think of them as lies. Think of them as stepping stones on the road to greatness.
Wait, I got it. Or turn around and go back. You'll come clean. You apologize for lying about being the wizard and for lying to that poor girl, okay? You gotta really seem contrite. You gotta sell it. Maybe you can even cry. Can you cry? I could cut up an onion.
Not going back. We're gonna find this wicked witch, steal her wand, I'll get that big pile of gold, and you can have a nice pile of bananas, all right?
As a parent, I'm curious, Adam. There's deception here, yet we know that Oz ends up running the place. Mm-hmm. It would seem that his actions yield more rewards than consequences. Without giving too much away, is that really the case?
You know, I think that's the case to a certain point. I mean, he really doesn't face consequences in terms of being punished for really his shortcomings morally. Now, that said, I think a key part of the story is his development as a character. He eventually runs into Glinda, the Good Witch, and she sees him really for what he is. At one point, she tells him that he's weak, he's selfish, he's slightly egotistical, and actually he's massively egotistical, and a fibber. And so I think if there's consequences here, it comes in the fact that he has to face his real moral and character deficit. And so I agree with you, there aren't really consequences, but he does have to sort of come to grips with who he is as a person.
Okay, some critics are calling this a family fantasy film. It carries a PG rating. Considering what the PG has come to signify these days, what do you think? Is it something that our munchkins can embrace?
Well, I think it is a PG film. Now, that said, there are a number of scenes that I thought were pretty intense. I mean, there's one with a witch running her claws across wood. Of course, we've got flying monkeys that turn up in scary ways here and there. And I've got young children at home, and I certainly wouldn't probably let my kids see it. And they're 6, 4, and 2. And I think, you know, families that have older kids, it would probably be okay. But, you know, The Wizard of Oz was known for giving kids nightmares as a child, and it certainly did me. I saw parts of it when I was really little, and I've never really gotten over it. And I think if you had really young kids, this could be that kind of film too. And I think the other issue that we probably need to talk about is the realm of magic. Obviously, magic and witchcraft play a role here, and I think that, you know, Christian families will want to talk about those spiritual issues too.
Yeah, the idea of good witches and bad
witches
and so on. All right. Good things to keep in mind before families set off to see the wizard, especially those with younger children. Thanks, Adam.
One man from every family must serve in the Imperial Army.
Father, you can't go.
Mulan, you dishonor me.
In the summer of 1998, Disney added an Asian princess to its iconic heroines. Based on a Chinese folktale, Mulan is the story of a young woman who poses as a man in order to fight the Huns in place of her aging father. It was also the directorial debut of Disney animator Tony Bancroft, a Christian with daughters of his own. I first met Tony about 10 years ago, so it was fun catching up and hearing him talk about animation, his faith, and his role in creating Disney characters who've become friends to our children. Tony, it's great to talk with you again.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Can you believe it's been 15 years since Mulan hit the big screen?
I cannot. When I think about it, I just get another gray hair.
Well, it got great reviews. It grossed over $300 million worldwide. A decade and a half later, when you think back to that experience, what do you remember most about working on that film?
You know, it was my first time directing. I was actually one of the youngest directors in Disney's history. I think I started when I was 25, 26 years old. When you're talking about a $100 million film, which is about what Mulan's budget was at the time, stress is part of the day-to-day life there. And I go to a lot of meetings, and the thing that I probably miss the most is in that kind of roller coaster ride of making the film. There's good days, there's bad days, but the best days were the ones where I could sit at my drawing board and remember what it was that I loved, what I was passionate about making animation, and sitting there and drawing the characters was kind of the highlights of my days, not always the meetings and the stresses and stuff.
You know, this season, ABC's Once Upon a Time added a few characters, including Mulan. Have you watched that show?
Yeah, my family and I watch it all the time. We love that show, and when Mulan came on, I was pretty floored by it. It's pretty surprising to see how she's just taken off now as an icon for the company. She means so much to me, and I remember when I was working on the film originally, I had very young daughters at the time. I think I had two at the time, and one that I didn't know was still on the way or yet to come. So with three girls in my household, Mulan obviously was kind of an iconic role model, if you will, for my young daughters. I knew that she would be, that I was creating this new Disney heroine for the next generation.
Home is that way.
I have to do something.
He
Did you see those Huns?
Are we in this together or not?
One of the creative decisions you made was having Mulan save the prince rather than the other way around, which I believe was the original ending to the old fairy tale in the Chinese mythology. Lately, we've seen that more often. What inspired you to go that route back then?
Yeah, it was kind of ahead of its time at the when we did it. I mean, I think to have that strong Disney heroine, but I think that's what I liked about the story. That's what drew me to it, was that it was a different kind of Disney heroine. She was a girl that was true to herself. That was the theme of the movie, as a matter of fact. But from frame one to frame 2025, her story doesn't change at all. She really is consistently who she is and believes what she believes. And that's what I liked about it. She changes everybody else around her. She changes how society views the role of a woman in that ancient Chinese culture.
Is it true that Mulan was the first ever Disney film to feature warfare?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I guess in some ways Pocahontas had, you know, some warfare, Indians against the settlers and that sort of thing. But yeah, and to have a military, you know, that she was part of an army and that sort of thing, absolutely, I think it was.
Dealing with violence and realizing that you were dealing with a G-rated kids movie, was that tricky?
It was. I remember there was one shot in the film in particular that we went back and forth on quite a bit. When Shang and his troops, including Mulan, come over the rise of where they're supposed to meet his general's army, they're supposed to meet up with them, and they come over this hillside, and we see this pan background. We just kind of pan along this background of all these troops, and we see the devastation that army was wiped out by Shan Yu, the villain, and his men. And we went back and forth on that background about how much detail do we see. Do we see gore? Is it really clear that there was a massacre here? Do we see bodies strewn all over and blood? And we must have painted that background three or four times just to get the right amount of tone so that in a G-rated film, the kids, the adults, the story would tell as there was a massacre here, they were all wiped out, without going overboard. And I think we found just the right level there.
It's a powerful moment. I remember one Christian film critic being really harsh with Mulan because of the Eastern spirituality. But I've always felt that while it's definitely something parents should be aware of, it's also a chance to show children another culture and explain maybe even what a missionary to China would encounter. Did your Christian faith make you any more sensitive to how you depicted those spiritual issues?
Yeah, it did. And I was very blessed and fortunate that my co-director, Barry Cook, was also a believer. And, you know, it's something I didn't know about him when I first joined the film, but that was one of the first conversations that we had was about our faith. And when he said that he was a believer, we kind of made a pact up front about how far we'd go with certain content, certain elements. And we talked about those things early on. And so that when we came across those issues, and one of them was that we were making a very culturally relevant and historically accurate, as much as possible, story about the Chinese culture. And, of course, Buddhism and ancestor worship was a big part of that original story and very, very culturally relevant in that historical time period. So Barry and I really struggled with how do we represent that and be true to the story and true to Mulan's story and the Chinese culture without becoming preachy about it, because it wasn't something that we believed in. It wasn't something that we wanted to put out there in a big way, in a preachy way. So we found different ways of handling tone. One of them was the ancestors are kind of a raucous group of crazy family reunion. So when the ghost kind of rises up out of the bays, you know, it's a comic sequence that's not kind of reverential. And so that was one of the things that we felt strongly about that we infused in there.
Yeah, you worked on a number of animated features at Disney. What are some other highlights from your career there?
Well, definitely Lion King. That movie holds a special place in my heart with Mulan. Because it was the first time I was a supervising animator. That means I had a character that I was responsible for through the whole film.
Hakuna Matata! It means no worries!
And in Lion King's case, it was Pumbaa the Warthog. Mm-hmm. And I remember when they told me that I was going to get that character, it was a huge day for me, and I felt so blessed with that opportunity. And again, I was a pretty young animator, so it really caught me by surprise that they gave me that opportunity, because I knew early on from seeing early screenings that they would show all the animators the screenings of the film early on. And I knew that was a standout character. Puma Timon, from an early moment in the inception of the film, were already the scene stealers. And to be able to have that, and then for the movie to then go on and become what it is now, such an iconic film and, you know, the history of film, has meant all the more to me.
Another character you worked on that is a favorite in my family is from The Emperor's New Groove, and that's Kronk. In fact, he went on to get his own sequel, so you must have done something right there.
Yeah, and actually a TV show, too.
That's right.
Cool.
I was a junior chipmunk, and I had to be versed in all the woodland creatures.
Yeah, it's amazing to me to see things that I've worked on that just kind of have a life of their own after I birthed them creatively. Then they go on and they just blossom into whatever they're going to blossom into. And it always surprises me. And I guess it is, I do kind of connect with it like a father in a way, you know, seeing your kids kind of go off. And but it is exciting. I'm really proud of that character and a lot of the films that I've worked on at Disney.
When Mulan came out in 1998, Tony, Pixar had already released Toy Story, and all of us sensed that the world of animation was about to change. Can you give us a view from the inside? What were you feeling, and what was it like working at Disney as traditional animation was giving way to CGI?
Yeah, I remember being in the middle of one of the animated features that I was working on at the time, and maybe it was Lion King, or maybe it was Hunchback of Notre Dame, I'm not sure which one. But the executives invited all the heads of departments, all the 2D guys, the traditional animators, to a big screening, and they showed us just one sequence that was completed by Pixar for Toy Story. And it was the little sequence where the army guys go down and they do their reconnaissance on the birthday party, and they report back to Buzz via walkie-talkie and stuff.
Okay, we're on the last present now.
Last present!
It's a big one. It's a board game. Repeat, Battleship!
It was just mind-blowing. It was one of those moments where I kind of felt like I saw the future in a big way. And I remember leaving there telling the other animators, I was walking back to my desk, and I said, I think we just saw the future of animation. We just saw, why would they want to make a movie any other way? That's kind of how I felt about it so strongly. And yet, it took years and years after that for it to kind of pan out that way. But now, traditional animation, which is why I got into animation, with the draw cartoon, is kind of defunct, you know, in a way. So it's a bittersweet thing for me. I feel like now I direct and supervise a lot of CG or computer animated projects, but at the time it was all 2D, and I kind of miss it, I gotta say, but I'm also really happy to have a new set of tools to make animation with.
Yeah. Tony, it's been great catching up with you. Happy anniversary, and if you find yourself in Colorado Springs, I do hope you'll stop by and see us again.
I would really love to. Thank you for your time, too.
That was really interesting. I love hearing that kind of behind-the-scenes stuff.
Well, Disney was kind enough to send us a Blu-ray copy of Mulan, which also includes the sequel, Mulan 2. What do you say we give it away to one of our listeners?
Sounds like a plan.
Stand by. Mail loading.
Because we've chosen to answer an email question he sent our way recently, the recipient of that Blu-ray double feature is Jeremy Levy of Parker, Colorado. Jeremy writes, I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast over the past few years and was wondering whatever happened to Meredith Whitmore. I thought she was a great reviewer. Well, for those of you newer to the podcast, Meredith was a member of our team for several years before she felt God calling her to other things. But we have kept in touch, and Jeremy, she appreciated hearing your kind words. She also wanted everyone to know that she's done quite a bit of traveling and has written lots of magazine articles, curriculum too. In fact, before coming to us, Meredith taught high school English, and she really missed that. So she's back in the classroom and loving life. Mm-hmm. I know, Adam, you were friends with Meredith as well.
I was, and Meredith, I think, has done pretty well since she's left here.
Thanks for asking, Jeremy. You know, Adam, we hate to see people move on from Plugged In because we really are a family here.
Yeah, you know, we spend a lot of time working and thinking and trying to figure out, you know, the right way to approach things, and we always hate to lose a team member.
Yeah, but it does happen, and to quote the lyrics of Billy Joel, life is a series of hellos and goodbyes. I'm afraid it's time for goodbye again.
Yeah, that's right. After 7 years together, we're having to say farewell to our designer and video game reviewer, Kevin Simpson.
Kevin, why don't you take a second to tell everyone why we're losing you and where you're going?
Well, after Rach and I have been married for almost 20 years, and we've never lived in the same town with family at all our entire 20 years, so we feel like it's now that we have Sydney, our two-year-old daughter, it's time to have family around again. It's very important. My dad is a walking testimony that Christ changed lives, and I want my daughter to be around that.
And yeah, that's in Ohio, right?
Yes. Yep, in the Cincinnati area, actually.
Well, we're going to miss you, though you will continue to review games for us from a distance, right?
Yes, I will. I'm going to continue to do that.
Now, you don't get bylines for all you do, but your creative fingerprints are all over our website. We really do appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate that. And it was really hard writing my resignation letter and everything. I didn't realize how hard it was going to be, but plugged in's been a lot.
Well, you're going to continue, even though you're not going to be here physically, you will continue to be a part of this team. Yeah. We appreciate you very much. Yeah. So it's time to say goodbye and thanks, not just to Kevin, but really to everybody who joined us today. Adam Holz, Tony Bancroft, our engineer Dave Salkeld, and you. We hope you enjoyed this official Plugged In podcast sponsored by the American Bible Challenge, back for a second season on GSN. Our Christian music clip is from Todd Ballard's new album, Anthems. We're going to hear an excerpt from the song Emmanuel. Have a great week. And join us again next time for more news and reviews. Kevin, you want to do the honors?
Because it's not just entertainment.
The official Plugged In podcast is a production of PluggedIn.com and Focus on the Family.
And I will be still and know that you are with me. And as I wait, oh Lord, I hear you clearly. Time. My hope is thine.